Hi, everyone. We're just getting back from our short break on the seventh day of Smartest 2008. And what better way to wrap up this jam-packed conference than with America's foremost creativity coach, Eric Mazel. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Ariane. How are you?
I'm really great. We are so honored to have you here today.
I'm glad I'm here. There's a gigantic storm rushing through San Francisco here. I wasn't sure I have electricity or anything, but I am here.
Oh, my goodness. So if you disappear all of a sudden, we'll know why.
That's right.
Eric is the author of more than 30 books and almost as many degrees. He's a creativity coach and trainer of creativity coaches. He's also a columnist for Art Calendar Magazine, provides regular segments for Art of the Song Creativity Radio, and he still has time to hold workshops in Verona and Paris. He brings vast knowledge and experience to the creative experience, and Smartest is really lucky to have him this year. Eric, listen, how would you like to handle questions that might come in as you speak? I can forward them to you later, or I can bring them back with me when I return on the line.
I think we have enough to cover that not trying to cover them as we go along is probably the answer. So let me handle them later.
Okay, great. That's what'll happen. And I'm going to jump off and listen with the artist on the other line, but I will be back. I can hear you, so if you need me, I'll jump off and come in sooner. And artists, I leave you in Eric's most capable hands.
Thank you, Ariane. I think I'm ready to go. Is that right? I don't get another prompt?
Yep.
Okay, I'm off. Okay.
You're on.
Great. So what we're talking about today are 12 great career-building habits that every artist can learn, and I think everyone has the basic outline, the PDF handout. So you know the headlines here, and what I'd like to do is simply go through the 12 points on the handout, go slowly through them, and elaborate on them and help you try to really understand them. So the first idea is that we need to overcome our resistance to doing business. And I think the smartest way to do that is to try to reframe doing business from selling to self-advocacy, because we all understand that we must be our own best advocate, our own best friend. No one else is really going to do it for us until, of course, we get some advocates in the marketplace. But until that happens, we have to be our own self-advocate. So rather than thinking about doing business as selling, think about it as advocacy. Then the next idea related to that is to append what I call a big but, a big B-U-T, at the end of the kinds of sentences where we try to talk ourselves out of doing business, like, I'm too tired or I'm too busy. And because we're tricky in our negative self-talk, we don't say flat out, I refuse to do business. We say things like, I'm too tired or I'm too busy. So what appending the big but there means is saying, learning to say, getting in the habit of saying, I'm busy, but I'm not too busy to spend 15 minutes on my art business. Or, I'm tired, but I'm not too tired to spend 15 minutes on my art business. So remembering to append that but is one of the smart little habits to acquire. And then the third, still same idea related to overcoming doing business, overcoming resistance to doing business, is the idea of resistance being a kind of thin veneer between us and what we're trying to accomplish. And I think that's really what it feels like. It feels like there's just something between us and our willingness to get work that we're not interested in doing done. And so I think a metaphor for breaking through that resistance, but also a great practical habit, is the following one. And I teach all my creativity coaches to do this, and they hate it to begin with, but then they begin to understand what the idea is. And the technique is to get an egg, get a dozen eggs, but get one egg, and before you have a task that you're not wanting to do, like sending out a certain kind of email or making a certain kind of phone call, crack that egg in a little bowl. Because I think cracking an egg for no good reason, it's easy to crack an egg when you're making a pie, but to crack an egg for no good reason, I think is the closest visceral experience we have to cracking through everyday resistance. And so creativity coaches who try it, discover that that after a few days they really get the idea that there isn't much between them and their willingness to do X, Y, or Z except this thin veneer of resistance. So as a practical matter, try cracking eggs before doing your art business. Moving on to point two. Point two is prove the exception rather than the rule. Because we know it's a competitive world, we know that the rule is that the majority of artists out there will not make it. That's just this simple supply-demand dynamics of the world. What that means is you don't want to be the rule, namely the person who doesn't make it. You want to be the exception. And therefore, you want to be thinking, well, what are the routine things that somebody in my position ought to do? And then, what can I do more of than that? You want to be the exception by doing more. And then a second thought there is, what are the routine things to do? What can I do differently? And I think differently is even more important than more, because when we think about more, we get exhausted, because there are already 1,000 things we're supposed to do, and then we're supposed to do more than that. So although more is an important concept, different is an even more important concept. We'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along. And then the third idea, and this is really the most important, I think, on this point, is to say out loud, I am the exception, or I will be the exception. I think you know from AA and other self-help models that saying things out loud is a very powerful tool. And so thinking I am the exception is good. Saying it out loud is even better. Saying I am the exception or I will be the exception is something that you ought to be doing on a regular basis. The third idea that we'll tackle is the idea of applying mindfulness techniques to business situations. And I think that there are many kinds of mindfulness techniques to talk about. There are basic ones like just quieting your mind, whether from Eastern philosophy or from Western psychology, we're beginning to understand that a noisy mind is a mind that can't have large ideas arise in it, that simply keeping small ideas in place is another way of preventing large ideas from arriving. So we want to do a better job of quieting our mind. And the technique that I think is the best is the one I wrote about at length in a book called 10 Zen Seconds. And it's the idea of marrying one long deep breath, 5 or 6 seconds on the inhale, and 5 or 6 seconds on the exhale, with important thoughts. You drop those thoughts into the deep breath, dividing half of the thought on the inhale and half of the thought on the exhale, and you use that combination of breathing technique and thinking technique as what I call an incantation or a verbal charm, as the way that you center yourself, quiet your nerves, and also remind yourself of what you're trying to accomplish. And in 10 Zen Seconds, I go through 12 of them, 12 of these incantations. I just want to chat about a couple of them with you now because I think they're actually very important. The first incantation that I talk about is I am completely stopping. That is, I am completely on the inhale and stopping on the exhale. Because we rush through our day, because we have so many tasks, because we are continually trying to get things done off of our to-do list, it seems like the best we can do is slow down, and completely stopping seems to be out of our grasp. That's why by breathing and thinking, I am completely stopping, we can actually create the experience of stoppage. And I'm pausing to model stopping. We can create the experience of stopping. And when we finally stop, then finally we are centered and we can have the ideas that are waiting to percolate, waiting to bubble up, actually come up. If we're still rushing along, we can't have those ideas. So before either thinking about a given business situation, an interaction you're going to have with a gallery owner, or a letter you want to write, or trying to write your artist statement, or anything that's business related, the first task is to completely stop. Because I think you know, you recognize, that if you don't completely stop, you'll just rush on to do something else on your to-do list that provokes less anxiety. Since these business situations tend to provoke anxiety, we avoid them. We rush on to the next thing. Forcing ourselves to completely stop is the way to get centered enough and reduce anxiety enough that we can handle these business situations. So of the 12 incantations, I think one of the most important ones is this simple one of stopping. All of the incantations except one of them have the same form, and then one of them, the work incantation, you change each time there's a piece of work that you want to get accomplished. What that means is you can think a thought like, I'm writing my artist statement, and drop that into the deep breath and have that be the way you help yourself to quiet your nerves so that you can get your artist statement written. And that would sound like, I am writing my artist statement. Deep inhale, deep exhale. Many of you who have tried this, what seems like very odious task of getting your artist statement written, know that it can take you months, if not years, to really tackle it, to really get down to doing it. Again, because it seems like a very odd kind of task, an onerous kind of task, and because it's anxiety-provoking to imagine that you have to say something about yourself that's so important in just a few words. Because that kind of task provokes anxiety, you want to really name it. You want to say, I am writing my artist statement. And by saying it that way, out loud, in the container of a deep breath, you'll produce the kind of power you need to actually get that task done. Any business task can be named like that. I am talking to the gallery owner. I am sending 2 emails. It may seem strange that it's so necessary to name the work we're about to do, but it is necessary because this is the kind of work we want to avoid. If we were less inclined to avoid it, we perhaps wouldn't have to name it. It would be more like second nature to get it done. But because it isn't second nature to get this kind of work done, it's really smart to name it clearly. We're really telling ourselves, oh, this is my next job and I'm going to do it. We're really having a kind of conversation with ourselves when we name it out loud that way. If we have time at the end, maybe I'll come back to some more mindfulness techniques, but for now let's hold that thinking and breathing combination as your prime and best way to get yourself centered before business situations. The next idea is the idea of rehearsing and role-playing business interactions, which I think is really very important, and I would bet that there are a few artists on the line who actually do it, or actually try to do it. The first step, or one step, is to get an art buddy, to get somebody in the business, somebody who is an artist, to role play with you. So if she has something coming up, if she has an interview with a gallery owner or a curator or some business-related situation, you get to play that gallery owner or curator for her. And if you have something coming up, she gets to play it for you. And of course you'll discover, your first thought may be, well, I don't know how to play the other person's role, but you will discover as soon as you try it that you have no difficulty in understanding what the person in that role might ask and might want. It's really not difficult at all once you decide that you're willing to get into the shoes of that person. The next strategy with respect to rehearsing and role-playing is to write out 10 questions or so that you might be asked in any business situation, any art business situation, and then answer them. Get in the habit of understanding what are the characteristic questions you might be asked, and then creating rhetorically strong, powerful answers to those questions. And they're going to be the most natural questions in the world. They're not arcane questions. They're not questions that are hard for you to figure out. They're questions like, tell me a little bit about yourself. Or, you know, how can you help my gallery sell your work? Or, do you have a mailing list where we can announce your opening? They're going to be obvious questions about you, the kind of work you do, and the ways in which you can support your work in this gallery or in this business situation. I think you realize that there's really no difficulty in understanding what these questions are going to be like. The task then is to write them out, these very normal-sounding, normal questions, write them out, and then write strong answers to them, not apologetic answers, not oppositional answers, but strong, rhetorical, affirmative, positive answers that help you get the gig. And then the next part of this, of item four, the next part of this puzzle, rehearsing and role-playing, is to actually visualize these interactions. Really play them out. Set aside 10 minutes or 15 minutes to, in your mind's eye, imagine a real interaction with a gallery owner. It might be a person you can actually picture, somebody from the gallery down the block where you haven't gone in yet, but you've sort of peered in the window and you know what this person looks like. Or it could be just an imaginary French or German gallery owner whom you're thinking about contacting, but you have no particular picture in mind. But visualize the interaction, go through it slowly, really play it out, and picture it not necessarily flowing perfectly. That is, imagine the gallery owner having to interrupt himself because the phone has just rung, or having to interrupt himself because a real customer has walked into the gallery, or something like that. In other words, try to make it as real a situation in your own mind as you can. Notice your own reactions when things aren't going well, and try to figure out what you want to do throughout each element of that interaction. Moving on to the fifth idea, maximizing your personality strengths. You have a lot of strengths. You wouldn't be able to do the art you do if you didn't have these personality strengths. You wouldn't be able to keep at it year in and year out if you didn't have these personality strengths. Then often when you think about the marketplace, you don't remember that you have these personality strengths, and the anxiety of the marketplace makes you feel weaker than you actually are. So you want to think through what your strengths actually are. Like if one of your strengths is being creative, then you want to use that personality strength and creatively think about what unusual or exceptional marketing strategies you might use. In other words, be as creative in the marketing of your work as you are in the creating of your work. That's a strength to utilize. If one of your strengths is that you find it easy to be alone in your studio, that you like being alone by yourself, if that's one of your strengths, because not everybody actually enjoys solitude. A lot of people flee from solitude. If it's one of your strengths that you enjoy solitude, then use that in the service of your art marketing. Take time in solitude to think through what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. Treat your ability to stay put as one of your strengths. Probably another one of your strengths is a risk-taking attitude. You take risks when it comes to the art you make, You may have adopted a style that's difficult and unusual and that you know is risky to undertake. Now take some risks in the service of your art marketing. Do things that feel like a stretch to you. If it feels virtually impossible to out of the blue cold call a certain gallery owner you have your eye on, say to yourself, well, risk-taking is a part of my nature. It's a part of my nature in the studio. Why not make use of it in my art marketing life? And you'll discover, if you're willing to think about it, you'll discover that you probably have a dozen or two dozen or three dozen personality strengths available to you that you could make use of in your art marketing life if only you considered them transferable skills, if you considered that you could transfer them from the way you use them in an everyday sense to directly using them for your art marketing. Conversely, and now we're on to item six, you want to minimize your personality weaknesses. You want to deal with those parts of your personality that aren't so pretty or don't work so well. For instance, if you consider yourself shy or introverted or one of those analogous kinds of words, you want to deal with that. You want to practice speaking, maybe do something like Toastmasters, find another way to speak in the world, because you want to overcome that shyness. You don't want that introverted piece of your nature or that shyness or that anxiety to be the thing that keeps you from making connections in the art marketplace. How sad would that be if something as handleable as shyness is the thing that's keeping you from making the connections you need to make? So you want to identify those personality weaknesses. They could be things like shyness. They could be on the other end of the spectrum. They could be your oppositional air. They could be the anger that you're holding or the disappointment or the grudges or the grievances. They could be things like that, in which case you want to ventilate those and get them out of your system so that you're not approaching art marketplace players with that kind of energy. But whether it's more like shyness or more like anger, whatever is the weakness there, you want to identify it and you want to address it. You don't want it to be the thing that robs you of 5 years or 10 years or 15 years of potential success. You want to meet it head on. By the same token, again, we're still in minimizing your personality weaknesses. By the same token, you want to, as best you can, eliminate your negative self-talk. That's a very big point. Because if you are saying to yourself all day long things like, and you'll be saying it just out of conscious awareness, so you're not quite hearing it, but if you're saying things all day long like, I don't really have any talent, I'm really an imposter, too late for me, there's too much competition, I can't possibly make it, Jane's a much better painter than I am, etc., etc. If you are saying things of this sort all day long, you know that you are knocking your legs out from under you. You know how difficult you're making it for yourself to feel powerful and confident and having any desire to go into the art marketplace. Well, cognitive therapists teach a smart, quick, three-step process for dealing with negative self-talk, and if you're willing to spend a little time working on it, you will find that you can use this for yourself. Step one is to identify what you're saying. That is to just hear what you're saying, which is an act of courage, because we don't like to hear these things. We don't like to hear that we're saying that we're not talented. We don't enjoy knowing that that's how we're speaking to ourselves. So it's an act of courage to identify our negative self-talk, but that's step one. Step two is to confront each of these utterances that don't serve us. So if you hear yourself saying, I'm not very talented, the next thing you want to say is, no, Hope I didn't hurt anyone's ears. No. No, that's the stupidest thing I've ever said to myself. I'm not going to say that anymore. So step one is to identify and hear. Step two is to confront. And you might think that's enough. Why isn't confronting it enough? Well, it turns out that there's a third step that's necessary, and that's substituting more affirmative talk. Because when we substitute that more affirmative talk, that talk begins to create new channels in the brain, new ways of thinking. We begin to actually think of ourselves in the positive ways in which we're talking to ourselves. So the way this would go is you hear yourself saying, I'm not talented. The next thing you do is you say, no. And then the next thing you do is you say to yourself, I'm perfectly talented. Or I'm perfectly fine. Or whatever language works for you. There's no affirmation police. There's no one who's going to tell you what's right or wrong to say as a thought substitute. You want to find language that works for you. But this is the habit that you want to get into. The habit of identifying your negative self-talk, confronting it each time, and then substituting more affirmative self-talk. And you will discover, if you can keep this up, you will discover that over time, you will have quieted, eradicated, erased the negative self-talk. It won't be there either consciously or right out of conscious awareness. It won't be there at all. And remember, from what I said earlier, it's not just the straightforward negative self-talk that you need to identify. It's not just a sentence like, I'm not talented. It's also a sentence like, I'm very tired. That's also negative self-talk, and it's tricky negative self-talk because it's got 30 or 40 grains of truth in it. We do get tired, and we are very busy. So when we say, I'm tired or I'm busy, it sounds like the truth. But it's only a partial truth. Because as busy as we are, we know that there is still time in a week to do our art marketing. So when you hear yourself say, I'm too tired to write my artist statement. Again, you have to do exactly the same thing. Hear it. Hear that you just said that. Confront it. No. And then substitute more affirmative language. I'm perfectly equal to doing my artist statement. A snap, a breeze, no problem. So to say this for last time, our personality weaknesses show up in ways like shyness or anger or etc. And they also show up in our negative self-talk, in the ways in which we talk to ourselves. And so we want to minimize both aspects of personality weakness so that we can grow into the artist and the salesperson that we're capable of being. We're on to seven now. Seven is get in the shoes of buyers. And I think here you want to set aside real time, half an hour, occasionally, and visualize yourself owning a gallery. Owning a gallery of the sort that you would like to show in. And picture what your day is like, what you need of your artists, how you deal with collectors, the real issues in your life, issues of what framing costs or what advertising costs or what your rent is. And begin to understand what marketplace players are dealing with, what their issues are, what their challenges are. Because A, you can then become more compassionate and humanize them more, but also B, you can help them with their issues. If one of their issues is that none of their artists do very much work in support of an opening, you, knowing that that's one of their issues, which they may not be speaking about, you, knowing that, can leap to the forefront and explain the two or three or four brilliant things you're going to do to help make your opening really exciting. So by visualizing being a gallery owner and thinking through what that means, you really help yourself understand how you want to present yourself to gallery owners. And then step two, step one is doing it in your mind's eye. Step two is going out into the world and doing it. That is talking to gallery owners, not from the standpoint of will you show me or will you put up my work, but just from the standpoint of what's up for you? What are your issues? In other words, almost do an informational interview with gallery owners. Ask them questions. Buy them a cup of coffee. Again, this is about taking a risk, being the exception. Most artists are not going to go in and have this conversation or this interview. You be the one who does. You be the one who goes in and says, I'm an artist. I really want to know your world so that I will better understand my world. So here are the 8 questions I have for you. On to item 8, and that is identify and prioritize your marketing tasks. And the word prioritize here has real meaning. That means choosing which things come first on your to-do list and which are the most important ones. You don't want every item on your to-do list to have the same weight, because then you really don't know where to put your energy. So what you're trying to determine is where the most reward might be for the least effort. So if you have a long to-do list of marketing tasks, a million things you can imagine doing, you really want to star 2 or 3 for each day, for today, star 2 or 3 for today, which you have decided are the ones which will give you the most reward for the least effort. And by that I mean, it is much easier to call up your friend Jane, who knows gallery owner John, and say, give me a contact here, get us connected, than it is to send out 2,000 emails to 2,000 anonymous gallery owners. And to leap ahead to it, to an idea that we're going to talk about in a second, you need to remember that what you're really looking for are not 2,000 advocates in the marketplace. You're looking for 1 or 2 or 3 really strong advocates, because that's what gets the ball rolling. You're looking for 1 or 2 or 3 good things to happen, not 10,000. So that's why you can star the 2 or 3 things on your to-do list that are geared toward, aimed toward, making those 1 or 2 or 3 important, useful connections. And to circle back around to an obvious point, you want to keep this list. You want to actually have a list of marketing tasks, and you want to keep this list separate from all the other lists you maintain. And I think you want to keep it up in front of you on a big erasable board so that you can't really avoid looking at it. So you have your erasable board with your to-do list of marketing tasks, and each day you star 2 or 3 that you're going to do that day, and at the end of the day you scratch them off. This is not a list that ever goes away. It's a replenishable, ever-renewing list, because there's always something for us to do. If we get in the habit of thinking that we can finally get our list done and then be free of it, we'll get ourselves depressed, because we can't be free of that list. Nowadays, where we are in the species, where we are in our evolution, we always have more of those things to do. Actually, the way I remind myself of this point is when I do a load of dishes in the dishwasher, I always leave a couple of dishes out just to remind myself that there's nothing about getting done here. This is not about finishing something off. It's just part of the process of life, getting some dishes washed. So you're going to maintain this list of marketing tasks forever. The items on the list will change. They may get grander and more lovely as you make better connections in the marketplace. They may show up on Oprah on Wednesday rather than some smaller tasks than that. But whatever it is, there are always going to be more of these tasks and a perpetual to-do list, and we want to buy into the idea that that's perfectly okay, that that's where we are. Where we are is having many lists that don't go away anymore. On to item 9. Item 9 is the idea of embracing the meaningfulness of marketing. And I hear this is really just one idea, one point to make here, and that is that a meaningful outcome, like having a gallery decide to give you a one-woman show, is made up of many half-meaningless steps, things that don't feel meaningful to do. It's a really big point, because if on a given day you do 20 things in support of your art marketing, each of which feels just like busy work or heavy or leaden, you will get depressed over time unless you remind yourself at the end of each day, unless you celebrate the fact that you're actually serving your meaning needs and are working towards a meaningful outcome, even though nothing you did on that day with respect to the art marketing felt all that marvelous or miraculous. We don't need the steps of the process to feel meaningful if we remember that we're working towards a meaningful outcome. On to item 10, which is find allies and advocates. I mentioned this before. All you really need is one advocate or two advocates or three advocates. And what that means is, if you know some people who are important in your world or in your life, keep at them until they scream. Keep at them until they get a restraining order against you. You don't want to half-heartedly contact somebody important and, because you got silence as a reply, not get back in touch with that person. If you get silence, which is what mostly we get nowadays, we don't get hate email in return, usually. We don't get criticism. We get that silence. If you get silence back from the art marketing activities you do, try again and try again and try again. And in this search for allies and advocates, you want to carefully look locally and carefully look worldwide. It's a big world now and accessible to us. And so to be sure, you want to know about every gallery that makes sense in your city, but you also want to be figuring out which galleries make sense all over the world and trying to find allies and advocates there also. And the most important way to do this, and I think you all know this, is to use your degrees of separation. Use the people you know. You may not know that the people you know people you ought to know, but they probably do. So what that means is telling all of your friends that your new suite of paintings is ready to be shown, and do they have any leads, any connections in the world that might be of use to you. So much of what we actually get accomplished, we get accomplished through these degrees of separation. In fact, today, someone sent me an email about a book proposal and said to me that an editor had contacted her wondering if the book proposal was ready to show and what did I think about that. And I said to her, because she knew me, she felt comfortable sending this email, I said to her, get in touch with my agent and see if you can make a connection there. And she then quickly sent an email to my literary agent, and to make this short story even shorter, this morning she had no agent and this afternoon she has a literary agent because she emailed me. And she would not have had a literary agent if without a degree of separation there. She certainly would not have had it in a matter of hours. Use your degrees of separation. On to thought 11, item 11, manage your moods and anxieties. We know that depression is a big ticket item in the lives of creative people. It happens a lot. I have a book that just came out in paperback called The Van Gogh Blues, which is about creativity and depression. And it makes the case for the idea that it is existential depression that bothers us the most, that plagues us as creative people the most, that we feel the meaning draining out of our enterprise too often, and we have trouble making and maintaining meaning over time. And obviously, this is a long, long subject to delve into, but to give the headlines here, the most important thing for you to do if you are feeling blue about either your artwork or your art marketing efforts is to keep reminding yourself that you matter, at least to yourself, that you matter to yourself. You may not matter to someone on Mars or someone on Venus or some gallery owner across the world, but you matter to yourself, and therefore, to make yourself feel proud, you're obliged to continue, day in and day out, trying. And tied to that idea, you want to identify meaning crises as they occur so that you can handle them quickly. If you send out an email to 20 gallery owners and get only silence, by the third day or fifth day of that silence, you'll be in a meaning crisis. Your art will not feel meaningful to you because no one's been responding. So you need to talk yourself down or out of that crisis through your rhetorical skills by saying, this work matters to me. I'm just going to try again. I'm going to try something different. I'm going to try something new. This matters to me. I'm not giving up. With respect to the anxiety component, art marketing makes us anxious, and therefore we need a little repertoire of anxiety management tools at our disposal. One is the breathing and thinking component that I talked about earlier. There are all kinds of other anxiety management tools like guided visualizations, and self-relaxation, things called discharge techniques where you silently scream to get the anxiety out of your system. To make this long story short, find one anxiety management tool that actually works for you. It could be something as simple as just deep breathing. Because that anxiety is so often present that if you don't find a way to relieve it, it can be the single reason why you don't get on either with your art or your art marketing. So have one anxiety management tool at least in place. And on to the last idea, the idea of balancing creating and marketing. I think the smartest way to do this is to set aside sacred time 7 days a week, first thing each morning, for the creating. That is, to really institute an early morning creativity practice. There are many reasons for this. One is that by doing your creating first thing, you will have made some meaning on that day, and the rest of the day can feel half meaningless and you won't get depressed because you will have built up some meaning capital already on that day. So I think a brilliant tactic is to have an everyday early morning creativity practice and then do your art marketing at some other time in the day, later in the day, with some meaning capital already in the bank. It won't even matter if the tasks in front of you don't feel that meaningful. You'll still be willing to do them because you've already gotten to your creating on that day. And that feels like a place to put a period, so let me put a period right there because I think we're right at time. So thank you.
Oh, my goodness, Eric. Yes, you are right at time. That is a great way to end that. And I think a great way to end Smartest, because without connecting to their creativity, all this material that they're trying to absorb from these last 7 days will feel daunting. Eric, thank you so much. It was great having you join us for this year. I hope you
thank
have
you.
A wonderful rest of the day.
I shall.
And you'll be hearing from us soon.
Thank you.
You can find Eric on the web at ericmazel.com and a list of his books on Smartest's new hot list of recommended books. This brings us to the end of our seventh and last day of Smartest 2008. You know, what occurred to me this morning after reading so many of your posts on the SmartWorks forum, which, by the way, has 35 topics and 199 posts and climbing, was the idea of change as a series of challenges. in the 14th century, challenge had come to mean being invited to a contest. And isn't this exactly what you are doing here at Smartest, inviting yourselves to learn, to change, to move closer to what you truly desire, to the ultimate contest of not living your dreams versus living your dreams? And suddenly I saw challenge as our ally, especially when we are feeling frustrated by one. Why? Well, because challenge serves to focus us and serves to clarify what we want, if only by giving us what we don't want first. So I invite you, as you take this wealth of Smartest art career material that has come to you over these 7 days, to welcome the challenges. Notice where they are asking you to focus. Notice where the challenges are giving you the control and power to make another choice. And please, until next year and our third annual Smartest Telesummit 2009, please remember the majesty of what you do and who you are. I am Ariane, the creator of Smartest and your host and moderator. Keep track of us at www.smartest-telesummit.com, S-M-Artist, A-R-T-I-S-T, dash, tele, T-E-L-E, summit, S-U-M-M-I-T, .com. Goodbye, everyone. Until next year.